You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley.
Oh my God. What is wrong with me?
It's all right.
It's the 22nd of May, 2017. I'm Benjamin Riley.
And I'm Simon Copland.
Welcome to Queers. Each episode, we talk our way through questions on a theme, and this week we're talking about queers and the state.
We talk a lot on this podcast about public debate around queer issues in Australia, and Ben and I have been thinking for a while now about the fact that there's a common theme running through a lot of these debates: the role of governments and other state institutions in protecting and recognising queers.
Arguably the two most high-profile queer issues of the past few years in Australia, marriage equality and the Safe Schools anti-bullying program, both fit the bill. In the case of the former, queers are asking the state to recognise our relationships, while for the latter, we are asking for government-funded, or in some cases even government-administered, protection for queer young people.
The idea of the state as a primary focus for the granting of rights and protections to queers is particularly problematic, given that, historically, the state has been the source of significant persecution for queer communities, through both laws, policies, and the actions of state institutions like the police.
So why are queers increasingly looking to the state for protection and recognition? How critical should we be of this approach, and what are our alternatives? So, Simon, in the hot seat, before we get too cynical, let's start somewhere a little more glass half full, although, you know, it's actually just a kind of like devil's advocate question, so you'll get to be cynical right off the bat, I imagine. Haven't we made, let me do that with a more appropriate tone. Haven't we made significant progress over the years in areas like legal rights for queers and even support through proactive government policies?
Look, I think let's start off the bat and be a little bit less cynical. Yes, I think is the actual answer. I think I relayed this experience I had with you when I was in... I had an experience with you in Melbourne last year, where I went to a conference, and there was this huge controversy at this conference because someone suggested the idea that things have gotten better for queer people over the past 10 years, and sort of people were outraged at this and saying, you know, that was a typical white gay man perspective. You know, but I think if you look at, you know, in terms of laws, in terms of legal status, things have gotten significantly better for queers over the last 10, 20, 30 years. You know, people are no longer facing persecution. People are no longer facing legal persecution for having gay sex, for example. Homosexuality is now decriminalized. You know, so we can't, you know, discount that kind of stuff. I think that's really, really important. And I think that progress is important. It's clear, and it's quite successful. And it's actually kind of important to start this conversation at this place in some ways, because I think it's actually important to recognize that work. And I do not criticize queers who decided that decriminalization campaigns were kind of important, and they were because...
Well, totally. And they've been going on for a long time, you know.
Yeah, so I think that that is really important, and I value that very strongly. I think where I get to is now we're sort of actually, in many ways, we're actually at a valuable position in relation to our relationship with the state, because some of those, well, majority of those really big hurdles have been overcome. With the decriminalisation in particular is a very key one, that we can have a more critical view of our relationship with the state. And I would say that, so yes, things have definitely gotten better, and I think that that's an important thing to recognise, but it's not good enough. And in fact, we need to, what I fear is that what's happening is that we are now taking too bright a light, rose-coloured glasses when we look at the state as queer people, and that so much of our focus is on relation to recognition and protection from the state, and I actually think that's not a good thing, and that there's a whole range of negative consequences to that. So yes, things have gotten better, but now is a valuable time to actually sort of critique and look at our position in relation to the state, and where do we go next is the kind of question that we're asking.
I mean, and you know, as always, in an ideal situation, we can do two things at once. We can continue pushing for legal reform, although there's not heaps left in Australia, as far as like stuff specifically. There's plenty of legal reform to be done that affects disproportionately affects LGBTI people, but in terms of stuff that specifically is like is directly about our communities, there's really not very much at all, you know, despite the kind of big ticket item of marriage equality still being there. I think ideally we can continue to engage with those frameworks. And, you know, obviously, you know, just from a pragmatic perspective, like those connections with government have all sorts of benefits beyond just the outcome of law reform. I mean, they're sort of that sort of political capital is really useful. It does to some degree translate into social capital, to put it in those really gross terms. So I think that we can still engage in those frameworks while critiquing them, and you know, ideally both of those things would be going on in queer communities at the same time. The problem is that they're not. There are absolutely parts of queer communities that are very critical of the state in kind of more radical parts of the community. But it's not really, you know, it's hugely disproportionate. I feel like this kind of points to like the really obvious question to ask here. Like we're sort of taking it at face value that this is that we should be critical of the state. Maybe we need to kind of break down a little more. Like, why?
Okay, this is probably where I'm going to get into my little, like, spiel, I guess. I don't know. Let's
do it.
Let's go with that.
Spiel away.
So, you know, I think that... So the first thing to understand or that I want to sort of get across is, like, that the state is not a neutral body out there. It's you know, that, you know, and despite all our perceptions, the state is not really, from my perspective, out there to best represent the people and to do these great people things. The state is there as an institution for a particular reason, and in liberal democracies, the state is inherently connected to capitalism, you know, and this is where we're going to get into a little anti-capitalist rant, where...
I'm just going to stop you really briefly.
Mm-hmm.
We might actually need to go back even further here and say, and define the state.
Ooh, now that's interesting. Oh, I never tried to actively define the state before.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it is kind of tricky, but I feel like it's, you know, I feel like, you know, quote, the state is such a, like, it's such a, like, wanky political theory. Like, it's the kind of thing that's just, like, thrown around a lot in, like, theoretical terms and philosophical and academic terms, but we like it's actually kind of meaningless, I think, to most people, and is not as a term used very much. I mean, I think it's a pretty, like, I would take that to mean, I mean, the government obviously, so that includes, you know, the kind of the, like, all of the branches of government, essentially the legislative, mm-hmm. the executive, and the judiciary, as well as the kind of broadly the public service, other kind of state institutions like the police force, like, I mean, like, essentially, you know, anywhere, I guess, like, state power is much more diffuse now, I guess, than it has been in the past, in that, like, so much of the functions of the state are outsourced. So, you know, I've worked for, like, pretty much every not-for-profit that I've... Oh, no, that's not true. Most of the not-for-profits I've worked for are, like, primarily government-funded. You know, that's kind of state power. So it's not just laws, I guess.
And other institutions, I think some of the key institutions that are really important to progressive thinking are things like welfare, schools, hospitals, those sorts of publicly run institutions are all the state as well, are connected to state power. And I think this is where a lot of this gets really difficult and nuanced, in that, you know, I'm for public schooling. So, you know, that sort of nuance around that is going to be a challenge that we might have to deal with. But, you know, I think that that's pretty good. What the sort of institutions that you described are a good definition. We're not just talking about, you know, the halls of parliament, I guess, but we're also not just talking about, like, it's the interaction between those halls of parliament and the public service and the judiciary, these other systems of state power.
So when we think about kind of the ways that state power is enacted on just everyday people or queers or whoever, it's not just like whether or not a law affects you, it's also even things like the ways, I mean, public school is a really great example, like the hospital system is a really great example, because it's like these things that we are forced to engage with, or we're not forced to engage with, but we are forced to engage with if we have no money to engage with these kind of public institutions, and that the kind of the experience of interacting with those institutions has an impact on us. So, you know, the way
Absolutely.
That, for example, being a student in a school socializes you in particular ways and shapes you in particular ways. That's a very kind of a very powerful example of state power, but one that's much more, I don't know, cultural, I guess.
Yeah, it's much more diffuse and almost, in many ways, much less controversial and not thought of. I think it's not thought of directly as being state power, but the sort of dispersion of power through these different systems is actually really an integral part of the state apparatus. And going back to where the sort of little spiel I was starting on before, I think that the relationship of queers with the state historically has been one of a state looking to oppress queers because of, from my perspective, because of a fear, or not a fear is not quite the right word, but because of seeing queers as being dangerous to systems of capitalism in particular and systems and the state itself. And so seeing, to take a step back, one more step back, I would argue that, that capitalism requires a nuclear family to operate, for the system to operate for a whole range of reasons, largely as a way to ensure that there's a new working class coming through all the time, and that also that domestic labour doesn't have to, is a sort of private, occurs in the private sphere rather than in the public sphere or is a thing that's paid for, and that queers presented a threat to that because we sort of said, well, actually, no, we don't need to have these nuclear families. We can have our relationships with no children and with lots of free sex and all this kind of stuff that doesn't exist inside these molds. And so what we saw is a state that acted to really in the late 1800s and early 1900s in particular define queers as being abnormal, but define homosexuality as being this abnormal thing, and to work really hard to institutionalize queers in particular, both through just imprisonment through legislation, but also through, you know, things like mental asylums and this sort of classing homosexuality as a mental disorder and using, and this is where sort of power gets really diffused because it's using, in that instance, it was using the medical industry as a way to exert its power. So that's really, from my perspective, the history of the state repressing queers. What I think I would argue and why we have to be critical of the state now, even as things have gotten better, is that the goal of the state hasn't changed in many ways or in all ways. And what's happened is that system of the family is still really important. It's still one that is being pursued very strongly. But what we've got is just an adaption of state. You know, as homosexuality has become more accepted, you have an adaption of state goals or state, sorry, not state goals, state tactics. And what we're seeing is the bringing of queers into the system and a whole range of rules that come with that bringing of queers into the system of being recognised by the state that potentially changes who we are as a community. And so I think that's the key thing for me about being critical about this, about our relationship with the state, is does having a good relationship or trying to have protection and what was the other word we used? Protection and recognition from the state. Is that changing who we are as a community? Is it changing our own values? And I think it largely is, and that's the major problem that I have, and the thing that we need to be critical of.
Sure. I mean, I suppose I would, you know, that's a very clear thesis statement.
it is my thesis statement.
I was about to say, yeah, I mean, this is something that you've done a lot of research on. I mean, I suppose I would just be keen to mess that up a little bit
and
broaden it out somewhat. Not so much as a critique, but just to kind of broaden it. You know, I would say to go to the first part of that around your motivations for the state to be oppressing queer communities. I mean, I think that, like, you don't necessarily need to look directly to capitalism to find that. I mean, you can also look at the much more obvious kind of thing of just populism and, you know, the desire for institutions of power to retain power. And populism is a kind of has been historically an effective vehicle for that, and that, you know, whether, like, obviously there is a co-constructive relationship between attitudes towards, for example, homosexuality in the public and attitudes from the state more directly. But, you know, I think there are certainly historical examples of the state persecuting queers because, like, that's, you know, to play into these kind of fears in the population around the other and kind of rallying, essentially, like, forming nationalism through creating a kind of other to persecute.
Absolutely, yeah.
And the second point I would make is, I mean, I think I totally agree with what you're saying around that we should be critical. Like, if this thing is having such an influence, if this thing being our relationship with the state is having such an influence over who we are and how we operate, that is, of course, then by default something we should be critical of because we want to have some agency in how we define ourselves and shape ourselves. But I feel like there's a way more, again, like, direct and, I guess, yeah, I don't know, direct is maybe the best word, direct motivation for being critical of the state is because, like, in the same way that we should be critical of all powerful institutions, especially ones that have a history of persecuting us, which is that they could persecute us again.
Yes.
More specifically, that because of the ways that persecution, if you look at kind of queers as a whole, whatever that means, is unevenly distributed. There are plenty of people in society now who are, like, queer people who are persecuted by the state. I mean, a really obvious example is that, like, you know, trans women, for example, experience kind of significant trauma within the prison system. Trans women and trans men, for that matter. So, you know, the gendered nature of the prison system, already a kind of really kind of violent and horrible state institution, is exacerbated, you know, exponentially by the experience of being trans in that system. And so, like, we should be critical of it because it could persecute us again, and also because if we have some solidarity as a community, we should recognize that some people will benefit from an increased relationship with the state, and while other people are necessarily being left behind, and we can't forget that, you know, like, there's an element of kind of throwing people under the bus here, that, like, by engaging with the state as a whole, you know, are we kind of just going, well, you know, those people who, like, you know, like, also, like, people like sex workers, people like drug users, like all those people that really experience significant state violence, you know, are we saying, if we're not critical of that relationship, are we saying we don't care about those people?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's good examples of the state persecuting us again. You know, we sort of framed some of this about things being getting significantly better. And I think in Australia, that's largely true. But then you look at examples of the United States, for example, where you've seen quite a strong anti-trans backlash in particular being implemented through state apparatus, so apparati, I don't know, some sort of plural of apparatus.
One of those.
You know, and so the North Carolina example is being, the bathroom bill being the perfect example of this, of a state, and a US state, a state government sort of implementing, sort of taking rights backwards actually in that state and making more restrictive. And That occurring, what's really interesting about that is that it occurred with such speed, you know, and there's been a lot of talk recently in Australia as well about sort of a right-wing backlash to queer progress, you know, coming with the attacks on the Safe Schools Coalition. You know, I think that we haven't seen the same level as what's occurred in the United States in some ways, as the sort of backlash that has occurred that, you know, in North Carolina created legislation that got passed very quickly and that had a real impact very quickly. And that's possible to occur. Our relationship with the state is not based on a genuine, in my view, it's not based on a genuine recognition from the state that we are, you know, suddenly sees us as real human beings who deserve protection. It's based on us as queers proving to them that we can be part of the system, and that the moment we start to we would ever threaten that again, they will turn on us just as quickly, or the moment that it becomes politically convenient for a political party to frame us as the dangerous other again, it'll be very easy for the state to turn on us again very quickly, and that's happened through history, and it can happen again. So it's a weak relationship that doesn't actually do us, you know, that we can't rely on long term.
I mean, why do you think that we are looking to the state more and more? Like, why, you know, how have we gotten to this situation? Why is the kind of the voice of, you know, anti-state radicals, which were a huge part of queer political movements, you know, 40 years ago, what, you know, why is that kind of diminished so much?
Okay, so I think, look, to the answer to this is probably the answer to everything that we hate in this podcast, which is identity politics. in a really interesting kind of way. So from my perspective, and I'm going to take us I'm spieling a lot in this episode because I'm like doing my thesis on this, my PhD thesis on this. So this is so apologies to listeners.
So he knows what he's talking about, people.
So from my perspective, what's really interesting about queer relationships with the state is that if you go back 100 years, and a lot of people don't recognize this, that if you go back to the late 1800s, early 1900s, the very idea of homosexuality was not even a thing. Like, people had sex with other people, but there was no term homosexuality, and there was no term heterosexual either. And what we saw in that period was the scientific community in particular starting to define homosexual and heterosexual as a way of delineating between the normal and the abnormal sexualities. And that led to a whole bunch of repression in the early 1900s and up to the 1950s and 60s and beyond. But it was the key thing that was used just to as a way to label homosexuals as being mentally as a mental illness and all that kind of stuff, which is you know, the campaigns to get that removed was really important. What's really interesting for me is when you come to the 60s and 70s, or even before this, when you sort of have this this history where those terms have been used, and those terms have then been used as a way to sort of create a core identity for someone. So it's not just that you had these labels placed onto you, but you were identified as a heterosexual or a homosexual, and you see you becoming this sort of sexual being through these identities. And so what happened when queers started to campaign for rights is that they adopted those identities, which had kind of been given to them by the state in many ways, and that became a core part of our very of our campaigning and our very being. So what you have this interesting thing where, and this is a thesis I'm working on, where what occurred is the very identifiers that we have were given to us by the state, and so we were sort of created by the state, and when in many ways identity structures were created by the state, and so when it comes to campaigning, it became natural to then turn towards the state to sort of as the way to sort of give us protection and to get rid of those legal structures that had been created, you know, created just in many cases just recently. So it's a nature of, you know, I think it's a nature of this sort of creation of the very idea of identity being asexual, you know, sorry, of your sexuality being core to your identity, which was a strategy used by the state and medical and scientific medical structures in particular as a way to oppress, but then sort of turning that back on the state to say, well, now, you know, if we accept, you know, change our behaviours in particular ways, then we can be accepted in. So that gives us a relationship to the state in some ways. Am I making sense, or am I just...
You are making sense. It's just funny. I feel like the way you're saying it almost makes it sound like we have been predestined to end up here by the fact that we were kind of granted these identities by the state. But, I think it's also a... sometimes I just feel like... I feel like a parody of myself. I'm just going to talk about capitalism again. Because this is something, I'm not sure if we've talked explicitly about this on the podcast, but you and I wrote an article for Overland Magazine, was that last year?
It was last year.
It was ages ago, that talked a bit about the relationship between capitalism and identity politics. And I think that's relevant here in that, you know, there's this idea in some anti-capitalist theory about naming something being a kind of part of the process of turning it into capital. I think that's a Zizek thing. I don't know. I don't know my theorists. No one looked that up because it's probably wrong. But yeah, I mean, it's almost like it's not just about that creating a relationship with the state, but it's like the idea of even inventing homosexuality and calling that thing a thing and making it a thing, like, ties us up into systems of capital that as soon as you give something a name, as soon as you make it discrete and real, you can commodify it, essentially. You can incorporate it into all of the different apparatuses that exist within capitalism. So whether that's the kind of stuff you're talking about through, like, you know, as soon as it exists, we can say that it's a mental illness, and then we have to repeal that, and that kind of ties us up into all of those structures. It's also, like, the more obvious things, like, you know, it becomes like literally a market that you can sell to, which is absolutely kind of what we and a market that exists for labor and all of those things, which is something that we kind of talked about more explicitly in this article, which we can link to if we haven't done so already. But it's fascinating because it does, again, at the risk of sounding like a parody of myself, it does just kind of tie together a lot of the things that we're interested in, you and I personally, and on this podcast, into one sort of idea.
It's funny whenever I say, like, well, it's all to do with capitalism on this podcast, I'm like, oh god, what am I talking about? But that's just basically what this podcast is in some ways. So we shouldn't be ashamed of that.
Well, I think we should be a little ashamed. I think Simon's almost looks like he's about to wet himself. You know, yeah, it's probably, I think there is a genuine risk of us becoming parodies of ourselves if we're not careful. So good to actually critique where we're coming from.
And particularly in this podcast where I can get on my little, my thesis rant. It's easy to be like, hey, Simon, step back for a second and actually think about this rather than the books that you've been reading every day for the last...
I feel like I'm just enabling you though.
I'm okay with that though. But I think, like, I think that you're talking about the naming of it is exactly what I was trying to get at, and you actually ended up describing what I was trying to argue much better than I did. In naming homosexuality, the state became able to regulate it in some ways, and then
not just the state, but like the market,
As well. Yeah. And so what that means is that inevitably, when we came to the point where and campaigns for taking homosexuality off mental disorder lists have been around for as long as since we were put onto mental disorder lists. But as things have gotten better for queers, as regulations have changed and those things have been revoked and things have gotten better, our relationship with the state has the nature of that relationship is still the same, in that it's still the state regulating us as the state and market regulating our sexuality. It's just being done in a different kind of way. And what I would argue is that what we're seeing now, particularly since with marriage equality campaigns, is that you're seeing it sort of being our sexuality being regulated in a less sort of hard-handed approach. It's less, put us in prisons, but it's more in a, like, we'll give you access to these particular things if you start to conform to particular norms. So you can have access to marriage, and you see this a lot with conservative reactions to marriage equality campaigns. The famous David Cameron speech where he said that, I don't support marriage equality in spite of being a conservative, because I'm a conservative. Because of the seeing of the capacity of queers to sort of, or maybe more specifically homosexuals, to be able to sort of build the institution of marriage and to be able to make it stronger by coming in, having children, getting rid of the sort of promiscuous the promiscuous, in inverted quotes, ways that we've had in the past, the ideas of free sex, the ideas of challenging the nature of marriage as an institution, all that kind of stuff. So it's like, come in if you let go of that sort of 1970s, 60s free sex stuff that you used to do.
Totally. I mean, the best way to, defeat anything is to co-opt it.
Exactly. Yeah, and so I think that's what the state has effectively done. It's done very, very well, particularly in Western countries, in the last, 20 or 30 years. And I think we have to be critical of that. And that's I guess, the crux of this episode, is that I think that is the critical nature that I would like to take towards the state, is like, well, what is the relationship actually doing to us as a community? And I don't think it's particularly good.
I mean, given how all-encompassing the, if we talk about, like, what the political fights are, or the kind of, the activism that we see in a lot of queer communities, it's so much of it is about the state, and certainly the big high-profile ones, as we've discussed. I mean, two questions here. The first being, I feel like I'm just asking you a lot of questions. It's fine. What are the alternatives in terms of strengthening our communities, or, forwarding our goals or whatever? And then secondly, can we point to examples where that's already happening? I mean, I suppose to briefly speak to the second one, I think there are some examples. I mean, even if I think about the work that I used to do in the HIV sector, I mean, obviously that sector is all very government funded. It's arguably, an extension of state power as well in that sense, the kind of really big programs that are rolled out by those organizations. But there's stuff, I think, that happens within those spaces that are interesting. I mean, I think this is something I have talked about on the podcast before, but they're called Prep Access Now, a group that I think they're all gay men who have been facilitating access to PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis of HIV. It's a very briefly a pill that you take every day, and it can stop you from contracting HIV, even if you have sex without a condom. And that to me is an example. It's a really great example of lots of things, and I think one of them is this really this activism that is completely separate from the state, and is in fact about getting around restrictions created by the state to be able to access that drug. So I think, you know, that's an example.
Yeah, and I think the history of HIV...
In terms of more... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the history of HIV activism, I think probably particularly in the US, less so in Australia, because the Australian government was quicker onto the issue than the US government was. But if you look at the 1980s, HIV activism was significantly about going around the state, and it was about queers in particular, but, you know, other people as well, building up their own knowledge about the potential of treatment for HIV, and you know, and doing a lot of the work that the state is kind of expected to do, but was refusing to do.
Fascinating. You're right. That is such a great example, because there's so much of that. I mean, the like buyers clubs are the obvious example, but there's heaps of other stuff. I mean, like, the whole, like, silence equals death is that, essentially. Mm-hmm. The like, kind of famous saying is kind of saying about the fact that the government was, you know, still the kind of narrative around, you know, thankfully still the narrative around the AIDS crisis in the US in the 80s is that, like, the Reagan government killed gay men by not acting on the AIDS crisis.
And so much...
Oh, sorry.
No, that's all right. I would cut you off. I'm going to say, you know, so much of the activism, there was a lot of activism about trying to force the government to do more, but there was a whole lot more that sort of was, and I guess in many ways, because HIV, the crisis was about survival at that point in time. So people couldn't, you know, it's not like marriage equality where people can, you know, can wait. People aren't going to die because marriage equality isn't occurring. Whereas in that case, people were dying. So there was this kind of dual thing of, like, trying to force the government to do more, whilst at the same time saying we need to do something because they're refusing to do it. And so we will find the knowledge. We will import the drugs. We will create these buyers clubs. We will, you know, do the research. We will do all of this sort of stuff and do it ourselves. And that process had a major impact on the government processes at the same time. It wasn't just a, you know, please help us, please save us kind of approach. It's like, we're working here to save ourselves because you're refusing to do it.
Yeah. It just reminds me of this, like, really amazing story that I heard about the Australian context about, I wish I could remember who was involved, but it was at a club in, I'm pretty sure, in Melbourne. Oh, this is a story sounding vaguer and vaguer, but where, like, basically drag queens were incorporating safe sex messages into drag shows. So I remember hearing this story from, it must have been someone I interviewed years ago for a story, about some, like, kind of skit about a I think it was about using protection for, like, rimming or something, because this was in the early days when we didn't quite know how HIV was transmitted yet.
Mm-hmm.
And so the person on stage, like, got a volunteer from the crowd and just, like, wrapped them up in just, like, huge amounts of glad wrap, essentially, as this kind of, like, funny sort of, like, you know, here's how you protect yourself from HIV. And the story I heard was that there ended up being a public health official in the crowd who'd been kind of brought there by someone in the community to kind of show them about these kind of education efforts that the community was doing themselves, and that ended up kind of having an impact on government policy around, like, funding the community to develop our own safe sex campaigns, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there's lots of that kind of stuff where, like, in the early days of the AIDS epidemic, I mean, gay men were doing everything, like, were the kind of guinea pigs in their own, like, research on what is, you know, what is and isn't spreading HIV. And, you know, like, obviously, I would never wish for that again as a, like, an impetus to be doing work outside of the confines of the of relationships with the state. But it is a kind of nice example to show that it can happen.
Mm-hmm. I think another example...
Nice is the wrong word.
Nice is probably the wrong word, but it is an example. I think another example that I just want to touch on, and I don't know the full details of this, so I'm going to have to research it. Maybe I can come back to it in another episode. But I was talking to a colleague who was telling me about an old organisation in Australia in the sort of 70s and 60s and 70s, and we were talking about queer safe schools, and this organization would write their own books on queerness, I guess, for young people, and then would go into schools and put them in the libraries themselves, and they would just do that rather than you know and sort of just do that actively and proactively and just go in and place books in and give them to schools and do that work themselves. They didn't rely on the government government to do that. They just said, well, look, we want to help educate queers. We don't, you know, we can just do this process and sort of do it actively. And again, you know, it's kind of one of those interesting things of like, you know, we've talked about safe schools, and I think that having these sorts of programs is good, but, you know, being able to have stuff that's led by a community is kind of really great too. And, you know, so maybe going back to that first question you had about sort of how can we do things differently, I think I've probably got two answers to that, and maybe I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this as well. I think that first is like we need to be more critical of the state and actually take a critical lens when engaging with the state. My view is not that we don't ever engage with the state, you know, and that the state is a thing, it's a big thing. We talked about the power that it has. You know, we can't just divorce ourselves from that entirely. So I think we've got to have...
Sure, we can't pretend that power doesn't exist.
Exactly. So we've got to engage with it. We've got to engage with it more critically. And we've got to recognise that, like, the state is still a system of power that is still using its power against us and will continue to do so and can turn on us very quickly. And so we've got to have that critical lens to the state, which I just think doesn't exist in many kind of ways. And then the second response, I guess, is to be able to put more emphasis on community... and maybe this is something we come to this conclusion a lot, in a lot of our episodes, you know, to be able to put a lot of the discourse around the state is like giving power to the state in particular ways about, you know, protection and recognition. And, you know, I think that we could turn that back and actually say, well, actually, let's have a focus on community, and not just queer communities, but just community in general, and the ability of us to, as a community, to work together to be able to both, I guess, deal with things like homophobia and the need to deal with that at a street by street level, rather than necessarily dealing with it, you know, relying on the state to do that for us, but also just as a way to sort of, you know, make happy lives. And one of the best examples, you know, the example that keeps coming to my mind is goes back to marriage equality. And so much of the sort of discourse around marriage equality is like, if I can't have my relationship recognized by the state or by a government, then it doesn't feel like a real, you know, then it sort of has this, you know, this it diminishes my relationship in some kind of way. And that's sort of a really emotional language that gets used quite a lot. And sort of my perspective as someone who's not married and doesn't want to get married is kind of like, well, I'm in a relationship and I don't need my relationship to be recognized by the government, because my relationships are recognized by my community very strongly. And that's actually the community relationship, that a recognition that is far more important to me. And seeing that there's a value in like the people around me supporting me and caring for me rather than the government caring for me, I think is actually much more valuable and is actually has much more meaning to me. And I think that sort of discussion is something that we could have more strongly.
I mean, marriage is kind of a weird one, because it is, in Australia at least, like almost entirely a symbolic thing.
Which probably reinforces what I'm trying to say in that.
It kind of works in both ways, in that it's like, you know, it's entirely kind of this symbol that we've created. But it's also like, you know, other than what you're saying of that kind of symbolic recognition outside of the state, it's hard to kind of talk about concrete pathways towards, you know, like how we might sort of act on it. Whereas I think the safe schools is a kind of interesting one, because, you know, we might be able to imagine similar ways forward to what you were talking about. And, you know, HIV is another one. There's lots of other stuff, you know, that's also happening in that space. I was thinking about TIM, for example, the Institute of Many, which is this kind of social and kind of community support space. That's, you know, that's an interesting kind of non-state engagement with those issues.
I'm laughing because every time, I don't know why, but I think for like the first time I heard about the Institute of Many, I read it as the Institute of Mary, and I was totally confused. And then I read it properly, and it made much more sense. And I was like, is this religious HIV organization? But then I knew who's running it, and I'm like, that doesn't make sense. And anyway, so now it made much more sense.
Institute of Mary, Mother of God.
But it made much more sense when I actually realized what its real name was. Yes. Anyway, so that's just a little aside.
Now, we have got... This conversation's gone on for quite a long time, so... we probably need to wrap it up. I feel like there's so much that we could still talk about here. So we might come... Maybe it would be nice to do... almost like have an episode focused specifically on like responses and...
Yeah, I think that could be really interesting.
You know, what we might do. Because I'd love to talk more about that community building stuff too, which you're right is a theme that we come back to again and again.
Yay.
But if you don't mind, we might wrap it up there.
Sounds great to me.
So thank you for listening, as always. We will be back with another episode in a couple of weeks.
And in the meantime, you can catch us on queers.podomatic.com or subscribe to us on iTunes. And the usual pleading, please leave us a review and rating, which will help other people find us. You know, we're not relying so much on the state, but we're relying on the metrics of iTunes so people can find us.
We're relying on the real state, Apple.
Exactly.
The deep state. Or maybe it's like the shallow state.
It is the global state.
Yeah, indeed. Oh, God, that's... Yep, okay. you can also send us an email, which you should definitely do, and people do, and we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is queerspodcast@gmail.com. We're also on Twitter, where you can talk to us in real time if we happen to be on there, but, you know, feel free to jump on and abuse us. I mean, no, don't do that. I don't know why I said that. So jump on and say nice things.
Yeah, be lovely to us.
Yeah, be nice to us. Or you know, thoughtful or critical or blah, blah, blah. I am at Ben C. Riley.
And I'm on Twitter at Simon Copland. And also on Facebook at Simon Copland Writer.
Now, because we appear to have gotten a bit delirious here at the end of the episode, we'll end it now. And we will see you all next time.
Looking forward to it, as always.